by the way.
Oh yeah. Not nearly as exciting as the Con Horror Stories panel, which I'm hosting right after this one that will fill the room. You may actually be getting reassigned to panel room one for that, or not. I talked to Salem earlier, he's not sure yet. This hotel definitely does have less panel, or less programming space than other con hotels I've been to, so that's something we can talk about. Right now, I'm waiting for my one co-panelist, Carl Weirskunk. I assume he's coming. He's probably at dinner as well. I just ran him into super sponsor dinner. Yeah, for this panel and for Con Horror Stories, yeah, but like one of my panelists is usually comes over from England. Not this year, he's not.
Yeah, I was planning on going to NFC this year, but then that got canceled because of COVID, so that was a whole thing.
Yeah, not happening. We'll see what happens this summer.
What was the summer?
Well, hopefully things will get better this summer. Hopefully we'll be over the hump with Omicron. Hopefully with just the human weather transmissibility will go down. Cases will go down. That's what's going to dictate how things go overall. And cases as well as fatalities. Seven now. I think their record for this panel was 12 one year. That was about six more than I was expecting. Because this is definitely going to be the boring panel. There's no way to sugarcoat that. A lot of the topics are not going to be very fun topics.
I was part of Saturday Morning Con Tunes in Boxborough, Massachusetts. I did a lot of panels. And at some of them, the attendance was zero. I actually did the panel. I had my recorder going. And maybe occasionally someone popped in. But usually it was zero or in the single digits. The total attendance was a little over 100. There were maybe 65 a couple of years before that. And no one wanted to go up to Boxborough. No one wanted to do a con. This is, I think it's a for-profit con. And it's cartoons, not furry. We did get some of the people that came here did show up. And they saw my classic cartoons panel and things like that. But I did five or six panels, and it was like this, or even zero or one. Well, you know, the first one wasn't too bad. But to do it, you know, and I think it's going to be scheduled this year the same weekend as Furrydelphia. I've already signed up for Furrydelphia. I'm going there. I'm not going to Saturday Morning Cartoons if it's the same weekend, or maybe not even any weekend.
All right. If Carr shows up, he shows up. I sent him a message. So we got seven here, so let's do this. Welcome to the How to Start a Con panel. Just a little about me. My name is Giza. I've been staffing conventions for 20 years now. Everything from just rank and file staff member up to the executive board level. I was on the board of directors for Anthrocon for 15 years. I'm one of the people that brought the con to Pittsburgh, which kind of changed the course of furry history such that it were. Oh, welcome. We got two more. Excellent. So, been staffing cons for two decades plus at various levels, and I helped not so much start a few cons, but I was with a few cons that are very early stages, including some like Furry Connection North, which some of you may have heard of, some of which are no longer around. So the way this panel goes is I'm going to start with a particular opening topic, and I have a whole list of things I could talk about, which just take hours and hours and hours, and we don't have hours and hours and hours. So once I cover the initial topic, you know, if there's something you want me to talk about or a question that you have, just raise your hand and I'll take your question. We can just kind of go into there just to address, you know, any needs that might come up. So what I like to start with for how to start a con is how do you determine if you even need for a con? Let me just move this up here so I don't have to stand. How to determine, you know, if there's a need for a con. And one way you can do this is by looking at, like, local activity in fanish spheres in your area. Is there a science fiction con? Is there an anime con? Because there's a bit of overlap with furries there. Is there, it's not so much relevant anymore, is there a My Little Pony convention? You know, things of that nature. Are these conventions already happening in your area, and what is the attendance like? If there's like a science fiction con that pulls in like 3,000 people, that's great for a furry con. You can also, if there's an existing con, you can also sort of do a bit of a stealth con by doing a furry programming track within that con. And that's how some furry cons actually got started. AnthroCon was the furry track at PhilCon. Furry Connection North was the furry track at Conclave. And Midwest Fur Fest was the furry track at a science fiction con called DuckCon. And eventually these tracks became so popular that it was like, hey, we could do our own con based on the attendance that we get. And the nice thing about having it start off as a track is that's essentially risk-free. You're spending time, but you're not spending money, you're not having to incorporate, you're not having to buy things, so the risk is a lot lower. So what if there's not a con in your area? What's something else you could do that's lower risk than start with a full-blown con? You have a Saturday picnic, you could do a bowling meet, like a fur bowl. So you'll see what attendance is like there and start making local friends, get some local interest. With things like a fur bowl, you can use that as a fundraiser even. And that's one of the things that kind of this con grew out of, some local fur bowls. Welcome. Oh my God, we might break a dozen. This is going to be great. If Carr shows up late, we're all going to point at him, by the way, and be like, you're late. He's not answered my message yet. So picnics, fur bowls, those are good low-risk ways to get started and to raise money as well, because raising money for that first year, it's going to be a bit of a challenge. You're not going to have like a leftover pool from the previous year. You're also going to be a new con, so reputationally, you're going to be a blank slate, and people may be hesitant to come a first year. So that's kind of, you know, how to make the determination of, do we want to start a con? Is there a need? Some first steps to take. I got more things along that I can talk about, but are there any questions about any of that so far? Welcome. Bye. Any questions about any of that, like how to determine if there's a need for a con, if there's a critical mass of fans that would become members to support it? I can talk about that.
What's like the number you consider critical mass? We have like a local bowling meet that gets 20 to 50 people.
Oh, that's a good question. So that's going to be geography dependent, because certain cities are more expensive than others.
Yeah.
Like New York City, don't host a con there. It's just too gosh darn expensive.
I'm not an hour east of New York City.
East? You're in the Atlantic Ocean?
No, we're on Long Island.
Also expensive, or so I'd like to believe.
I'm Staten Island.
Yeah, that's going to be expensive. Downtown Philadelphia is going to be expensive. AnthroCon was there for a year. Pittsburgh is surprisingly a lot less expensive than Philly, which was a lot of the reasons for our move there. What also makes a difference is what part of the country you're in, and if a venue is union-controlled. Philly is a union-controlled city. There's a city in Connecticut, I can't remember which one, that is union-controlled, and that just means like their convention center is super expensive because union labor is more expensive. Cities like Pittsburgh, less so. Cities like Pittsburgh, the unions will negotiate with you, especially if you're a nonprofit. We would tell the various unions, look, here's how much money we have. You can have it all, and if our event succeeds, we'll give you more next year. And that actually went over really well with them.
and we started like the 15 or so years that Anthropon has been in Pittsburgh, we need more and more union labor over the years, and that was a win-win for everyone. The cities on the West Coast, it tends to be less of an issue. You ever go to a con and you see like a big con suite? Well, not now with COVID, but before COVID, you go to a con like MFF, you see like a big con suite. Chances are that's not union control, because otherwise the food service union would be like, no, we want to serve that. So that's a consideration. But back to the original question, I got a little off topic there, I'm sorry, regarding, you know, demand, what critical mass would be. The more expensive your area, the higher the critical mass. If you're in like a college town where there's not a whole lot going on, like in the middle of Pennsylvania, there's a state college, it's in the middle of nowhere. And there's an anime con called SetsuCon, that had a few hundred people, and that was fine because the hotel it was at, it's not like it was a major destination, except for a few times in the year, you know, when parents would visit students. Beyond that, like, it was not a heavily used venue, which means it was cheap. And cheap venues, there's nothing wrong with like starting at like a Holiday Inn with a few function rooms or similar. Like, you don't have to be at a Westin. I think one of Anthropon's early hotels, like up in Albany, was a Holiday Inn or similar. Furry Connection North's first year was at a Best Western, and that place was a dump, and we never went back after the first year, but it was a great, it was a super cheap venue. I think our total costs for function rooms that entire weekend were like $6,000 or $7,000, and we had every function room in the hotel. And that was a super good deal, and the next year, we moved on to something better. There's nothing wrong with being in a place that's just a bit tiny the first year, because then it's like, hey, we overflowed this hotel, let's move on to something bigger and better, versus we're running around in this giant hotel that, you know, is being underutilized, but we got to pay for it. So, yeah, in Long Island, you're going to need a lot of people for an event, but bowling meets are an excellent thing, and I think you should keep doing them. And they're not a bad way to raise money as well. They're not a bad way to identify, and this kind of gets into staffing conventions, you know, identify who's interested in helping out, what skills do they have, you know, where could we use them in staff. One great way to find staff members is steal staff from other cons. That's a tradition. I staff a bunch of cons. The new NFF just changed their con chair for the next year. The new con chair is a guy named Duncan DeHusky, who used to work for me at Anthropon in the early 2000s, and now I work for him, and that is a tradition in convention staffing. Recruiting staff members from other cons is totally allowed. How do you meet staff members from other cons? You staff other cons. And that's a great way to get experience, volunteering and staffing at other cons. You can see what a con is like, you know, being run from the inside. And it's a great way to get experience and see what happens and meet people. And you might see stuff come up where it's like, oh, I hadn't even thought of that thing. You know, I'll kind of put that into my knowledge base for considerations that I have when I'm trying to start a con. See what else I can talk about from my list here. Let's talk about budget. Budgets are always fun, especially if you're a nonprofit. If you incorporate as a nonprofit, there's two kinds. There's a 501c3 and then a C7. The C3 is the pure charity. There are very few cons that are. Midwest Fur Fest is one. There are a few others. Getting that C3 is pretty difficult, and you get a lot more scrutiny from the federal government. If you get a C7, the C7 is a social club, which is kind of vague, which means you get a lot less scrutiny. You don't get tax-deductible donations, but personally, I find the trade-off to be worth it because you get a lot less scrutiny from the IRS and a lot less headaches in that regard. You can always change. There's a process to change if you decide, well, we want to become a C3 someday. It's a thing. But starting as a C7, most furry cons are. This con is a C7. And on the finance front, so there's the money raising aspect, trying to raise money through something that's not a con, such as picnics, such as bowling meets. And then once you have this money, how do you go about spending it? Negotiation with hotels is certainly a thing. If you get a hotel contract, you can totally negotiate it, be like, well, I don't like this fee, I'm going to cross it out and initial it and send it back for their review. You probably want a lawyer to do that, though. Furry lawyers are a thing. I'm sure most of the room has heard of Boozy Badger. he knows a whole lot of lawyers. If you were to DM him and say, hey, I'm in this state, is there a furry-friendly lawyer you can recommend? I'm sure he'd have a recommendation. Having a lawyer to review a contract is a very good idea. Having lawyers for things like in the incorporation aspect, it can't hurt. Filing for a service mark, it can't hurt. A lot of cons, the name of the logo is a service mark. If you would ask me what is the difference between a service mark and a trademark, I'd say you need to talk to a lawyer, which is why I said to get a lawyer just now. But the Anthrocon, the paw print, and name Anthrocon, that is a service mark. You see the letters SM next to it? That's the service mark. And there is some enforceability that has to be had. So if you see an Anthrocon t-shirt at Fernando's or wherever, they actually have a license agreement with the con to sell that. And usually it's the way for the con to bring in extra money per shirt sold or what have you. And that's negotiated at the con's pleasure. In terms of what use of their service mark they want to permit. As far as questions of, like, how do you figure how much to charge for memberships? Once you get a contract in place with a hotel and they tell you how much you're going to charge, look for setup and teardown fees, look for service charges, look for sales tax, try and get a commitment out of the hotel in writing. What's going to be our final, like, the check we're going to be writing you at the end of the con, what's that number going to be? Then you can start to look at, all right, how much attendance do we think we're going to get? And you can start to come up with prices based on that. Google Sheets is your friend. Google Sheets is your business partner. Google Sheets is your late night drinking buddy. I can't say enough good things about Google Sheets. Something I've done before is I'll create a revenue matrix. I'll make a row, and I'll put like number of attendees in a row, 50, 100, 150, so on and so forth. And I'll make a column, and I'll put in membership fees, 30, 35, 40, 45, so on and so forth. And then I'll use a formula, and I'll go multiply. And now I can start looking at a range of numbers of revenue, and I can start to see patterns, these membership numbers and these membership prices are going to be like this many thousands of revenue, and I've actually gone so far as to start shading the cells different colors, and I can start to kind of visualize of like, all right, for this many members, what do I want to consider charging based on what my fees from the hotel are going to be? And there's going to be fees from the hotel, fees from like the AV provider. Larger cons will rent their AV equipment. But if you're a smaller con, you might have options. There are some, there's a whole group of furries who do AV who talk to each other. There's a guy named Audie who some of you may have heard of. He staffs a ton of cons. And it's like, if there was a new con that had some AV needs, he might be a good person to talk to, or he might know someone in your area. And AV equipment being loaned/donated to cons for smaller cons, that is a thing. There's a bunch of furries who do AV, and this comes back to the part about staffing other cons and it being a great way to meet people. The guy who does AV at this con, Drac, he staffs a bunch of cons and does their AV and knows a bunch of people in that space. So, like, making friends in the convention staffing scene is just massively, massively helpful. Any questions about staffing, like general management stuff while we're on that topic?
Yeah, what's the kind of overview of our hierarchy of staff for a different
con? Ooh, that's a good one. That's a good one. So how hierarchies go, it varies by con. So with this con, we have board of directors of 5 people, and some of them do double duty as department heads, con chair, and then we've got I can't remember if it's heads or leads. I can't remember the term. We've like got basically a higher set of managers under the con chair, so which will be major groups like technology and media and commerce and safety and things like that. And then under each of those, you'll have managers with individual staff under them. So commerce might have things like dealer's room and artist's alley and con store with individual staff under there. Safety might have shift leads under that. Media might have like a website, con book, Twitter, things of that nature. I'm actually the sole exception at this entire con. I'm the Department of Law, and I'm guest of honor liaison. I report directly to the chair because that's just kind of a weird role, and it I talked to so many other division heads about guest of honor related things. And cons like AmpterCon has a more pyramid-shaped structure. You've got con chair, board of directors, each of which is a department head, which is basically a requirement to be on the board, and then their staff under them, which in some cases include managers and shift leads and that sort of thing, and that varies by department. Now, an interesting thing this con, Amphir New England, does is there's two designations for staff. There's core staff and seasonal staff. Core staff are staff members that have that staff the con year-round in some way. So, like, for guest of honor liaison work, I'm talking to the guests of honor throughout the year about getting assets from them. Other departments like media, they're working on the con book, or they're running the social media, or things of that nature. Seasonal staff are people who just work at the con. So like staff member working a cash register at the con store, they're a seasonal staff member. They show up, they staff the con, and when they finish the con, their commitment to the con is over for that year. So there's two different groups of staff, and that's used for things like awarding hotel rooms, so which some cons do. We talk about room blocks, actually. Anyone here know what a room block is and why it can really mess you up? I see one person nodding. So when you, I'm sorry, someone say something?
I haven't heard of that.
All right, you got two people. So when you hold an event at a hotel, you get rooms in bulk for your membership, and you generally get a price that is a discount compared to like what you would get if you just walked up to the front desk and said, give me a room. But there's something you have to give the hotel in return. The hotel will ask you for a commitment to fill those rooms. So if you say, I'm expecting, I want to get 100 rooms in this room block, you're telling the hotel that you will have those rooms filled. If you don't have those rooms filled, what most room block contracts say is that the hotel is allowed to bill you for what that revenue would have been. So if you do some mental math, it can get horrifying super quickly. Like, if you've got rooms that are $100 and you fall 10 short on your room block, well, that's $100 a room night times 3 nights, that's what, 30 room nights, $3,000. So 10 rooms go unfilled, you owe the hotel $3,000. No ifs, ands, or buts. If you're really lucky and you have a really good relationship with them, they might let you off the hook. But if you don't, and if you're under by a lot, that can bankrupt a con. So room blocks are super tricky, and it's easy to expand a room block. It's really difficult to contract one. And I was going somewhere with that. So filling the room block is important. Having the contract is important. Sometimes what will happen at larger scales, once you get past a few hundred room blocks, I don't know why this is done. It's a hotel thing. Like, I don't work in that industry. But what hotels will do is they'll put something in the contract and say, for every certain number of room nights you fill, we'll give you one room night credit. So with AmpterCon, it's like every 50 room nights that are sold, we get a room night credit. And those room night credits are use them or lose them. That's how staff rooms will get paid for at cons often. So if you're running a con, you'll at least get some rooms out of it for some of your senior staff. And beyond that, it varies by cons, and different cons do different things. Like, some cons actually have housing departments where you can apply for a room and they'll match you with other staff members. Some cons will give a group of rooms to each director and be like, all right, your department, do whatever you want, however you want to give them out to your staff is fine. And otherwise, those are, just normal hotel rooms otherwise. So that's the hotel room thing. Hotel contracts are scary. Room locks have to be filled. Relationships with the hotels. Don't dress like me if you're doing negotiations with a hotel. Dress business professional. Guys, shirt and tie. Ladies, dresses or pantsuits or whatever. I don't know ladies' fashion, sorry. Dress business professional. And you want the hotel to take you seriously. And if they take you seriously, that bodes well for you because you get a good relationship out of that. And that can lead to things like the hotel saying, we're going to ask this group before you to leave early. Or we had a hotel say to us at AmpterCon once, we were touring the main ballroom, and they're like, yeah, that group of outlets in the back, they're not metered, so if you plug a bunch of stuff into that, we won't know about it, and we can't bill you for it. And they didn't have to tell us that, but our convention services guy rather liked us. Having a good relationship with the hotel can sometimes save the con itself. Something a hotel can do, if con's coming up, if it's like Wednesday or Thursday before the con, and the hotel's getting suspicious, they think you won't be able to pay your bill, especially if you did not meet your room lock, they are allowed to ask you for full payment up front, which can be into five figures. And I've seen the first year cons get hit really hard by this, where their hotel got nervous and their hotel's like, yeah, it's Thursday night, we need $11,000 if you want to hold the con tomorrow, and the con would have to come up with that money. That's obviously never fun. But if you have a good relationship and the hotel trusts you, especially if you met your room lock, if you filled out your room lock, that's far, far less likely to happen. Catering is super expensive. Was anyone at the super sponsor dinner before this? Was I the only one there? All right, trust me, it was a nice dinner, okay? You're gonna have to take my word for it. Those plated dinners where you get like three-course meal and dessert and coffee after that, it's easily gonna be $50 a plate plus. I'd say with inflation the way it is, and it being a few years since I've done such a contract, probably about $75 a plate. And this is the thing with hotels, it's a secret with hotels. They make some money on rooms, but they make a lot of money on their catering. If say we want to get like a one of those coffee like carafes for a function room, those are $100 plus each easily. The hotels make a lot of money on catering. So if you're hosting a super sponsor dinner or a super sponsor luncheon, that can actually get expensive. Also, speaking of super sponsors, I'm sure everyone in this room has seen the pricing tiers for conventions, and it's like attending is $50. Sponsor is $100 and you get a print. Super sponsor is like $275 and we'll give you some food too. And you know, if you're doing the numbers in your head, it's like, well, wait, the con's making a lot of money on those higher tiers. And that's the point. The point is to sell those higher tiers because that brings in more revenue for the con, which then the con can use to pay for some of the more expensive things. Like say this luncheon or super sponsored dinner is $75. Well, you know, that's, you know, subtract $75 from say $275. That's $200. It's still $150 of revenue over what a regular attending is. And if marketed well, that can go over. That can go over quite well for the convention. And I'll use Midwest Fur Fest as an example. Midwest Fur Fest has a sponsor. I guess a luncheon they call it. It's the one that's Saturday morning. And because for whatever reason they have really good rates on their catering there, I don't know the numbers, but they're able to have the prices for sponsorships a little lower, and they hit this tipping point where they get like 1,000 sponsors. And the number's just ridiculous compared to their total attendance. I've never seen another con get that high of a percentage of sponsors. So that's a ton of revenue for the convention, and it's just a great thing for them. So, anyone have any questions about hotels or contracts or finance or anything like that?
Not a question, but I wanted to bring up, you were talking about Staten Island and Long Island and things like that. Furpocalypse is in the process of moving to Stamford, Connecticut, but it missed out on 2 years because of COVID. Stamford is, I think, maybe about 35 miles from New York City, so a lot of the people in the tri-state area will probably want to go to it. But like I say, they missed out on 2 years because of the pandemic. The hotel they were in was, let's talk about horror stories. Whatever it was called, the Red Lion, or it had different names, and Cromwell, really horrible. But it looks like hopefully they'll get something going, but that's going to become more of a New York con now, or a tri-state, as opposed to, say, southwestern New England. It's moving a little bit that way. It's a little further from me now, but you're going to get a lot of New York people. So maybe people in the tri-state area will wind up going there. Hopefully they'll come here too, of course. But
I think our farmer in Long Island is really excited to go.
They're excited about that.
They're excited to go to the new Furpocalypse Hotel.
But, I had high hopes, and all of a sudden you look on Twitter and with a heavy heart, and I'm like,
yeah.
It's the same thing.
Not again!
Yeah, so actually, this reminds me of something that's really worth sharing. What happens if you have to move? Like, especially if you have to move to another city, what happens then? Like, Anthrocon went through this when we outgrew Philly and had to move to Pittsburgh. Oh, and our hotel closed by surprise as well. That was fun. Our hotel closed suddenly. And having to move across cities can be harrowing. What happens if you have to move cities and, you know, you're suddenly a lot closer to another established con? What happens then? And the best advice I can give is that there is sort of a gentleman's agreement of sorts, where if you're going to kind of encroach on another con, you're like geographically, or maybe you get moved to another date and you're like a couple of weekends away from another con in the area, it's considered appropriate to give them a heads up first before any sort of public announcement is made. And it's a great way to at least try and build a little rapport with that other con and be like, look, we're really sorry this happened to us, we had no control over it. And most of the time the other con is going to be understanding, because we're all in the same community here, and they're going to understand that, you know, hey, your old hotel got condemned or whatever happened, like in the Furpok example, or your hotel got sold, like what happened to us at Anthrocon. And people are generally pretty understanding, but don't let that other con find out when everyone else finds out, because I've been on the receiving end of that too, and it sucks. It's quite a shock, and it will also leave that other con going like, what's going on? Are these guys trying to screw with us? Are they trying to siphon off some of our attendees? Just leaves the hurt feelings all around. So I'll always recommend to have back channel conversations if able, which another reason to staff other cons, because you meet other people that way. And even if you don't know senior leadership from a particular con directly, you might know someone who knows them, and you can use good old-fashioned networking to get an introduction and have that conversation. Now, a funny thing happened. This really isn't going to happen anymore, I don't think, because furry cons have kind of reached a saturation point, but there's a lot of cons in the U.S. When Anthrocon moved to Pittsburgh, we actually got a thank you note from Western PA Furry Weekend, because Western PA Furry Weekend used to be held 4 times a year. And the person running it was like, oh, this is great. I can dial that back now that Anthrocon's here. That's not likely to happen again, though, just because we've got cons all over the place now, just about every major city. Pull up my list of notes here. Let's see, put that in. We got budgeting, we got staffing other cons. Let's talk about social media. Social media can be fantastic if leveraged correctly, because it's free. Like, well, I shouldn't say it's free. We're all suffering for it in one way or another, but actually using it, Twitter is the big one, Instagram's a big one, Facebook's a little less big for furries. It's free to make posts. It's free to get buzz going. It's free to post Fursuit Fridays. You know, if the con hasn't happened yet and you need Fursuit Friday photos, get together with some fursuiting friends some weekend. Take a ton of photos. Take 52 photos, and you have a year's worth of photos for Fursuit Friday. And when I started doing Fursuit Friday photos when I ran Anthrocon's Twitter feed, like, it was just free eyeballs. People would love the pictures, they would fave them, they would retweet them, so it'd show up on other people's timelines. And I'd see tweets with like 10,000 impressions in a couple of hours, and really all I did was post a fursuit picture and tag it Fursuit Friday. And that's a great way to get that mind share going, especially, you know, when you're like between years, you know, you're at that low point, like 6 months after 1 year, 6 months before the second year, you know, it's not much going on. That's a way to keep your brand alive in people's minds. You know, they keep seeing tweets from you at least once a week. They're going to remember that your con exists, especially if you're in a more competitive environment. Competitive might not be the best word, because, like I said, we're all in the same fandom, and it's happened a handful of times when a con was started specifically to screw with another con. Never ends well. Never ends well, like, for anyone. Just not a place you want to go. So, if anyone's thinking, like, oh, I want to start this con because I'm super pissed at this other con, don't go there. It's just not worth it for anyone involved. There are other, more constructive ways to address a situation like that. Let's see. It is 9:33. So, we got about 20-ish minutes or so. Any questions so far? Like my mouth's, my mouth's getting dry, and I haven't had edibles, so I know it's from the top.
Yeah, I was wondering about sort of getting the message out there, like getting people to know about the convention coming up.
Twitter,
you gotta mention that.
Twitter's the cheapest way. I mean, absolutely have a website. Please, for the love of God, have a website with working email. And websites, that's actually pretty straightforward. There's websites as a service at this point. There's one called Squarespace, which I used for Anthropon several years ago. And it's just a content management system. It's like, upload your images, choose your layout, type your text, and you get a really nice looking website, and it will render correctly on phones and iPads and full-blown desktops. And like Squarespace, I've had very few problems with. Having some sort of like authoritative website, like that source of truth, is always helpful, especially when you get to things like scheduling, when that starts to happen. You definitely want to have some sort of a source of truth there. One of the neat things that this con did is if you go to app.anthropnewengland.com, there's a phone app, which it looks like it's just a thin wrapper for the website, but that's fine. It's because it's something you have on your phone, and it works super well. I use it all con when I'm looking something up, and it works great. So let's see, we got website/domain name, social media. Those are by far the biggest ones for having communications. Facebook page and an official Twitter account. You're not going to get verified on Twitter for a while. I learned that one the hard way. You generally have to have substantial like press coverage in order to get that verified check mark. Like it took me years to get it for Anthropon's Twitter. Midwest Fur Fest got their check mark a couple years later. I don't think any other cons have gotten verified since then. It's actually it's a pretty high barrier, especially with Twitter revamping that. We think so. To be covered, kind of covered promotion. Sometimes outside the box thinking for promotion can go really well. There's that aspect of like doing picnics and fur bowls, because those tend to get a lot of attention in and of themselves. You know, people will be talking about it on Twitter. Doing banner ads can be interesting if done creatively. Like, if I say banner ads, everyone's probably going to be thinking, like, oh, you know, we'll use either Google AdWords or maybe try advertising in Fur Affinity. Many years ago, about a decade ago this was, when furry migration up in Minneapolis was starting up. Furry Migration is an all-ages con, and they don't just mean it in name only. Like, there is an actual children's track at that con. Like their audience, you know, includes small children. It's like, you know, you're a child, you know, under like 13 with a parent or legal guardian. It's like, we got programming just for you. So you think banner ads, you think FA. No, Furry Migration advertised on E621. Right. And it was one of those things, people saw this, and they're like, what? Is this for real? And they clicked on the ad. And the ad got something like a 6% click-through rate, which is astronomical for a banner ad. Banner ads are usually less than 1%. And it was just one of those things that made no sense, that it shocked people when they saw it. They're like, wait, this is being advertised in E621? And it got them attention. And it helped them get, I don't know if they directly tracked registrations, like through the sales funnel, as it were, but they did get eyeballs, and therefore they got mind share, and that's important when you're a new con. You want to try and get mind share. Welcome. Wow, I think we might have over 15 people now. This is great. This is, I think, a record for this panel, and I'm both excited and scared for what that's going to do to the next one. Let's see. Businesses. So, if you've been to Anthropon downtown Pittsburgh, you know, you go two steps out the front door and there's restaurants and bars all over the place. That is actually quite helpful. You go, let's compare to Midwest Fur Fest, not that I'm specifically picking on them, they're a great example of the opposite. You go out the front door of Midwest Fur Fest and what do you get? You get coal. That's what you get. Because other than, I think there's a place around the corner, there used to be Hofbrau House. There's not a whole lot at Midwest Fur Fest that is not the hotel itself. And when you're looking at a venue, you want to try to find a venue that has cheap food within walking distance. Because keep in mind, the biggest age group in furry is people between the ages of 18 and 25 years old. And that is not a group that is exactly flush with money. So you can find a venue that's near cheap places or even food trucks like this con does. And that's one of the things that Midwest Fur Fest did to try to alleviate the food issue. They brought in food trucks. That will help. And that's even something that's advertising worthy. You can make a selling point out of that. It was something we did at Anthrocon when we moved to Pittsburgh. We were like, there's all this cool stuff downtown where you can go to eat and drink and hang out. And reaching out to businesses and trying to work out any sort of deal with them never hurts. Sometimes businesses will give attendees a discount. You know, sometimes they'll do a special menu. If anyone remembers Tonic, that used to be in Pittsburgh at the corner of, I think it was 10th and Liberty?
Where the bus went through the street. Right next to where that bus...
Yeah, in front of the Westin.
Yeah.
It was if you got the Westin and it's kind of to the left of that street corner, they had like a furry menu. Fernando's had a furry menu. Well, Fernando's had the dog bowls. And other restaurants would do the same thing. They would have, they'd have furry-related things. Subway tried it once and they never did it again. I don't know if anyone heard about that. If you search for Anthrocon and Subway menu on Twitter, they made a menu and the best description I can give is an attempt was made. And in hindsight, I kind of wonder if they did that on purpose because it got them so much attention because everyone was talking about it because the menu is just so hilariously, it was like they took furry terms and just like, you know, rolled dice and put them into a menu. And they made no sense. But in local businesses, it's like, you know, if you're like, we're going to be having a conference, they want your money. They want your attendees' money. They want people to eat there. So local businesses do tend to be pretty receptive, especially at this point in the furry community's trajectory. Mid-2000s was a bit of a different story, but by this point, furry is known well enough in the mainstream that businesses are wise to that, and they will generally be pretty nice to furries and make it clear that they want you to eat there. So let's see what else I can talk about. Any questions?
Yeah, I guess that raises one. Do you ever have issues trying to find venues or sponsors around like PR or people with misconceptions?
Did you say with sponsors?
Venues or trying to restaurant deals that you were talking about, like here they had discounts and trying to reach out to other local businesses. Do you ever have issues with people not wanting to associate, like a hotel saying we don't want to associate with?
It's pretty rare. I think the closest we've come that I can think of is sometimes venues just don't return our calls, and it's just one of those like, okay, we get the message and we'll stop calling them. But it's so rare. Like the worst I ever remember happening was one year at FCN, the charity said, we reached out to a charity, it was the Humane Society. You know, it's like, we'd like to have you be our charity this year. They said no. And we're like, what? So we found another charity, and I think we raised like $20,000 or something. I think we might have mailed a copy of the check to the Humane Society and been like, this could have been yours. Yeah, that's the weirdest rejection story I've ever heard of. I think businesses may have seen so much stranger. Like, furries compared to some things aren't all that strange. I know it even got to the point when we made our first trip to Pittsburgh and they told us about some other conventions, which I won't repeat the names of. They weren't furry conventions, they were just other genres. They were just like, yeah, you're a lot less creepy than those other people. And they made names and it was like, wow, okay then. Furry as a whole, it's that group of like 18 to 25 year olds who, they might drink a bit, but compared to some other events I've seen, furries are pretty harmless compared to some other things that I've seen. So, let me think. As far as venues trying to turn you away, like it's not really been an issue. Like, I know we've had some of these venues give us outrageous prices, but it's hard to tell if it's like, oh, because this was downtown Philly, because downtown Philly is always expensive. Let's see what else I can cover here. We've got 9:43, so we've got about 10 minutes. leadership, so that's always a fun one. Something to keep in mind is the person who founds a con and starts a con in its very early development, like years one through three, may not be the best person to lead that con going forward. Different styles of leadership. For example, some people are great with like small groups and coordinating small groups. Some people are better leaders at the executive level. Burnout is absolutely a thing. The three people who founded this con no longer staff this con. One of those people left Furry entirely because of the stress involved. After a decade and a half of being on AnthroCon's board, I stepped down. I went to registration because that's less stressful than being on the con's board. So burnout is a thing to keep in mind. If you're starting to feel signs of it, or your staff are feeling signs of it, it's definitely important to engage in self-care, and if you need to cut back on some duties or even step down entirely, that's okay. The most dangerous year I've seen for conventions, a couple years ago, I basically took convention like attendance records year after year, put them into a spreadsheet, and I started looking for patterns. And the most dangerous year is not the first year, it's the second. Because the first year of a new con, everyone's excited, they're like, we're making a new con, this is going to be awesome! And then the con happens, and the con is busy and stressful, and after year one is over, they're like, oh crap, we got to go through this all over again for next year. And that is when people start to drop off of staff, and I've seen cons not have a second year, or sometimes just implode after that second year. Second year is the riskiest, because stress and anxiety and burnout can all take their toll. And if you're the person at the top, if you're like the con chair, and you're just like, I can't do this anymore, best thing you can do is nominate a successor. Make sure they're cool with taking on duties, and then stepping down and either just walking away entirely or just taking a rank and file staff role, and that's fine. As far as executive leadership goes, another challenge to that is that if you work for a large company, you generally have various types of leadership. You know, managers, directors, vice presidents. Then you have the people who do the work, and they're what we call individual contributors, or ICs. If you're running a con, you're going to be doing a little individual contributor work as well, definitely to start. But a large function of your job will be managing people under you who are doing the work, and that requires a different set of skills. It requires some social skills, some empathy, conflict resolution. It requires some really, really good communication skills, because those are the soft skills when you're trying to get people to do things, and that's more about setting a narrative and getting people to follow along. And then you get into things like trying to recruit people, trying to retain people. Sometimes it involves you have to fire someone because they turn out to be a bad fit, or they turn out to be toxic. I've had to go through that a few times. If someone's presence on staff is causing morale to go down and they're making everyone else unhappy, you have to pull that person aside. And I think the corporate term is called counseling now. You have to counsel that person. It's also the term a come-to-Jesus talk is also relevant. You need to stop doing this thing. And there are books on that. If you go to Amazon, search for management books or leadership books, there are books written entirely about this that are worth reading. There are courses on, let's see, Coursera. That's what I have in my notes. This came up before. Coursera has business courses that you can take about how to lead organizations, and that's definitely worth looking into. There's also, I'm just going to mention this for Google, for anyone who wants to Google this. There's a type of leadership called facilitative leadership. There's a type of leadership called servant leadership. I have a friend who's a CTO and knows that. It's a type of leadership called transformational leadership, and that's about trying to change an organization in some way. Hey, Nightlines, I see you hiding in the back. What's up?
Hello. Early.
Yeah, Nightlines is one of my fellow panelists for Convention Horror Stories, as well as guest of honor at this con.
What's up,
Andrew?
It's me. Hi.
I thought it was you. Can't quite tell the mask. I see the mask on. Andrew is one of my other co-panelists, and he is the guest of honor for Circles for Con Horror Stories. Is Salem hiding back there? Did I see Salem?
No, Salem's not here.
Okay, because we might be getting moved to panel room one for con horror stories. I don't know.
Yeah, he's still downstairs.
He needs to get up here.
Right?
He really needs to get up here. So where were we? We were talking about leadership. So a whole bunch of stuff that can be Googled there. And there are different philosophies and different styles of leadership as well. Like facilitative leadership is a big thing where I work, and that's more about the whole leader setting the tone thing and trying to provide their staff with what they need, and then basically set the staff up to succeed as opposed to setting someone up to fail. Let's see what else. Wow, cool. We've gone through most of my lists because someone else bringing up working with businesses. I check that one off. We got a few minutes left. What else can I talk about while I'm up here? What questions do people have?
What are some of the other common difficulties that you find?
That was most of them. Beyond that, it starts to get into con horror stories territory. You know, that starts getting like acts of God. Here's an example. Anthropon's 1 year. This is 2005. That weekend, we switched to a new hotel for just that year. We had storms over about a third of the country, which completely screwed up flights. Our one guest of honor didn't make it in until Saturday morning. And then that was the weekend there were the terror bombings in London. So we had a whole lot going on. That impacted attendance, especially people flying from England. That didn't happen that weekend. So, things like that will happen just completely out of your control. And that's kind of where having those good relations with the hotel can come in handy. In our case, we didn't quite make our hotel room block that year. And the hotel just said, don't worry about it. Because they saw that, they saw people... people had to cancel rooms at the last minute. They knew what was going on in England, so they were pretty understanding about it. They didn't have to be. Their contract said they could have charged us the full amount of those rooms that weren't filled. They just looked the other way. So to have good relations, it can so pay off with your venue. To that note, good relations with the venue is something that a lot of cons will tell their hotels is, if you have a problem with an attendee, let us know and we'll do what we can to handle. And that's usually things like noise complaints with hotel rooms. It's one reason why conventions have their own safety and security departments. Because then the con security will go and deal with the noisy rooms so the hotel doesn't have to. I see a hand up.
Yeah, I was actually going to ask about how you handle security. I already set that up because I noticed that there's security at this convention.
Yeah, so security, and it's funny you mentioned that because that was like my first decade. I did a lot of operations in security. Generally, the kind of persona you're looking for people on security is more like London bobbies, not like German stormtroopers or the like. You can't have, for liability reasons, you can't be laying hands on people. If you touch someone, that becomes a liability issue. You generally want people on security who are the type to de-escalate things, who will be like, hey, can we get you to do that or not do that thing, rather than shouting. Like, you don't want security to be shouting, you don't want security people to be panicking. If someone is being unruly or otherwise causing problems, you can always escalate. And that's the kind of serious stuff that you do want to get the venue involved in. If someone is being a big, big problem, the venue has their own security and they'll help. Like, we've occasionally had people trespassed from con hotels where hotel security would escort them out, sometimes with local law enforcement. And that person told, if you step back on this property, you're going to jail. And that's also plays to the part where the venue is your partner. So if you're having a difficulty of some kind, like say a certain person says that they're going to show up at your con unvaccinated, just to screw with people, that's the sort of thing you can let your venue in on, because the venue usually doesn't want that person there either. AmproCon got actual bombing threats several years ago, and like instantly behind the scenes, Pittsburgh police as well as Pennsylvania State Police were looped in on that, and there was an investigation because they take that seriously. Our venue was aware of that as well. So We're getting towards the end, and I don't know if this is the same room or con horror stories is going to be. All right, one last question.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm wondering what you think would be the most important, sort of like a important roles for the founding team of a con, and especially the ones that might be surprising. So I imagine there'd be someone who'd be in charge of finance, security, like you were just mentioning.
Hotel liaison? Yeah, okay, yeah. Hotel liaison, social media / web person, finance, legal, let's see, dealer's room, sometimes Artist Alley comes under that, sometimes our con store will come under that. Programming can be a big one, especially depending on the size of the con. Like Amphicon is a programming department with a dozen plus people on it. You see different tracks, you know, an art track, a writing track, you'll have like, maybe like a LARP track depending on the size of the con and the type of the con. And a lot of this does expand out over time. Like I've seen some small cons where the con chair and the hotel liaison are the same person, which is the case at this con. And eventually when the con becomes bigger, all right, time for a separate hotel liaison. So I think that's time. Thank you all for coming. I'm going to try and track down Salem to see if Con Horror Stories is going to be in this room or the one down the hall.
It's going to be in here.
Is it?
Yeah, right?
Yeah, well, I was talking to him earlier, and I'm like, no, there's going to be a lot of people, right?
Yeah, I was asking out there because there's a line. They said it was going to be in here. That's why we really popped it here earlier.
Yeah, I think the schedule says, see Salem's out here real quick.
If not, I can text them for you.
Yeah, text them.
Right? You're like, yeah.
Look on stage. It's great.